Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers, and I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent. I'd like to invite you along to attend one of our worship services. We meet each Sunday morning at 10:30, and again, you would receive a very warm welcome. If you don't live in our area, why not go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button and find the nearest Lutheran congregation to where you live. Go along and join in their worship or their Bible study. Today we're pleased to welcome back an old friend of Lutheran Radio, Dr. Robert Rosin. Bob is Professor Emeritus of Historical Theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, and Bob is back in the UK doing some teaching at Westfield House, as well as speaking around the country. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks. Very nice to be here again.
We're going to, surprisingly enough, talk about the Reformation. We have just celebrated the 500th anniversary of the posting of the 95 Theses. And the question comes about, I've heard it asked on media even here, was this Luther's personal crusade to reform the church, or what really did bring it about?
Well, the answer is definitively yes and no. On whether it's his personal crusade. It is, in a sense, not that one should think of it as sort of Luther's hobby horse, as if he gets off on some tangent, a quirk, and decides the whole world has to be informed of the grand insight he's had. There would come later people in a more radical variety of the Reformation who thought God spoke to them directly, and they had a message for the rest of Christendom to sort of suddenly pivot and follow them. That's not personal in that sense. It's personal in the sense that Luther understood salvation, understood theology, as being personally directed to him, and that what Christ did, what God did in sending his Son in the person of Jesus Christ, was as if it were for Luther and for Luther alone. He found personal comfort in the message as the scriptures were unpacked before him, and he took this message then to heart. It made a great deal of difference in his life, an immense difference in his life. He said he felt as if the gates of paradise had been flung wide open. And then he realized that if he had had problems, and then had come to see this comfort and this love of God, this grace of God, he's not different. He is, in fact, kind of like everybody else. Then everybody else could probably share and benefit from the same message, would in fact benefit and share from the same message. So Luther becomes then a kind of key figure. He becomes a key spokesman for this, but it's really a reformation for everyone. In terms of dealing with history these days, we often look upon history sort of from the bottom up, kind of mass movement history. They used to call this prosopography. It's a term I hadn't heard for a long time until I heard a BBC podcast about a week ago where someone was talking about different methods of doing historical research, and they talked about prosopography, kind of group biography, bottom-up history. What does the common man think? In olden days, go back to the 19th century, the British may still remember Thomas Babington Macaulay. He was a Whig historian who died in the middle of the 19th century. And Macaulay said history is at bottom biography. It's the story of great men who make history. And then others are just kind of along in tow, as it were, riding on the coattails. This is not really popular today anymore. There was a BBC podcast again about a program that a producer, a man named David Starkey, I guess is known to quite a few British. I brought his name up before in different contexts while I've been here, and I see heads nodding. And he said, as he was preparing a series for BBC Four, that he realized that while he personally was not all that interested in the message, that was too bad, and while he personally had nothing, no water to carry for Luther, that the more he looked at this, the more he realized the Reformation simply couldn't be told without the person of Martin Luther. Certainly there are things happening, but he says, he said, you take Luther out of the picture and you have a completely different movement, and who knows how things ever would have turned out. On the other hand, put Luther back in and you get the Reformation that blossomed around him and grew up around others. and gave us a very different world that we have today. So it is, in a sense, personal, because it leans heavily on Luther as a figure. It's personal because it leans upon Luther and the theology that he discovered again, and brought back with the attitude that if it's important to me, it's important to my students. They're also human beings, and it's important to the people outside on the street. It's important to the world. So personal becomes, in a sense, universal for Luther.
But Luther wasn't the first who called for reform. So what happened to the ones before Luther, and why did Luther's call for reform actually kind of take root and grow?
Yeah, these are the big questions of history one can never finally answer. I mean, you can't put together a formula and say, do it this way and this will result. We look back and you try to grab all sorts of different factors, and there, frankly, are always too many to hold in a hand and to account for. But generally speaking, you know, you can get an idea of why things develop as they did, and or why things turned out one way and not another. In other words, why are there reform efforts earlier and they don't amount to what Luther finally did? Where do you want to start? See, there's a phrase, Ecclesia semper reformanda est. The church is always reforming. It was actually popularized by Karl Barth back in 1947, about, in some of his writings. But Barth claimed, and others have said, that it's really an echo of Augustine's attitude, namely that living in this world, in this kind of penultimate age, with Christ still to come again, things are always in flux. They're in flux in the world around us, and they're in flux also in the church as it encounters this world that's always kind of on the move. So the church is always sort of looking at itself. It ought to, at least, do a kind of a stop and check, take account, adjust as needed. The idea being not to adjust the core message that's there, but you have to adjust in order to communicate with people. People have different issues, different problems, different hopes, different fears along the way, and you have to know how to sort of get the foot in the door at that point, their particular door, and deal with it. Well, the reform is always around because there are always problems. The church is made of sinful human beings. Things will happen, go wrong, need correcting. We could back up to into the Middle Ages, and you see, say, for example, in the 13th century, there was a time when the papacy was going through a low stretch. There was a time when there were not one but two people who claimed to be pope. This came about because of a kind of garbled election near the end of the 14th century. And two people, two rivals, each claimed authority. And a movement arose in the middle of this period, where the split itself came, the initial pope was sort of acting rather high-handed. A movement arose called conciliarism. There were people who said, theologians who said, we're not going to do without papacy. We need this leadership. They're still wedded to this idea of pope being in the See of Peter and thereby Christ's authority. But they said, he is more what we today would sort of call a CEO, a kind of chief executive officer to implement, whereas the real weight of things rests upon the councils. Councils are the collected wisdom of the church, and they would point back to Acts 15, to the Jerusalem Council that solved a problem over whether you needed to keep the Old Testament law still or not. Paul went out in that case, and Peter readjusted his thinking. Or they looked at early church councils. The first seven councils were theological questions came up and were solved. There, a new factor comes in because Constantine meddles, once you've interjected politics, the process is never quite the same. But councils had long helped the church, and so in the middle of the 14th century, these theologians said, councils can be the wisdom and the guidance of the church. The problem is, of course, to get papacy to go along with it. And so the theory was there. One pope became two popes. Conciliarism pressed the issue at the Council of Pisa in 1409. They thought they had both men willing to step down for a third compromise candidate. And when the dust settled, they were left not with one pope, but with three. The other two changed their minds. And three lasted just till the Council of Constance, 1415. This is the same council that burned John Huss. We'll come back to him in just a second. And by then, it was so obvious things needed fixing that they came to a conclusion, came to an agreement on a compromise candidate, a guy named Martin V. And the council also passed a decree called Frequens. Frequently, we will have councils for the wisdom and the guidance of the church. The problem is, of course, that councils come and then they disperse, go home, and the papacy is left behind. So conciliarism, while it's an effort to reform the church, to give it guidance, to clean up moral abuses, these things are hard to implement because they're not constantly around. Papacy is another place you would hope would lead, but often papacy is the biggest example of what needs fixing. It's very hard to give up the lifestyle, the power, the authority. And some of them probably genuinely thought, I'm here in a position of responsibility. I can't turn my back on this. There are efforts also sometimes at universities to rethink theology and critics there. But it's not really a kind of substantive theological change like Luther offered finally. It tends more to kind of tinkering with how we philosophically understand the world around us. They refined theology, the idea of justification. We should come back to that, the medieval that Luther learned and then came to reject. They refined it, but they didn't really change the basic dynamics of it. So, again, a kind of reform effort that falls short. There are monastic groups that arise and say, we're going to be a model for what the church should be like, but they're often too small to make a difference, or they themselves can fall victim over time to sort of fudging the rules, you know. So we can't have a Buick, or we can't have a Vauxhall personally, but the order, the chapter house, can have a Vauxhall, and go that way. I mean, that's, you know, you sort of skirt the rule a little bit, and their reforming efforts go. There are medieval mystics who think that we come to some sort of climb a ladder to God through purging ourselves, then illuminating, and then union. Purgation, illumination, union. The problem is mysticism is very individual, very personal. And the church as a whole, and even society, often looked at these people as just a little bit kind of crazy. You know, they're not quite sure how to deal with them. They were often members of a monastic order or members in a cloister if they're nuns. And so they're kind of under church watch. That's good. The church likes that. That's another effort to try and change and reform things. Then there are individuals. I mentioned a moment ago John Huss, but even before Huss, here in England, they would remember John Wycliffe. Wycliffe was an Oxford professor who had his problems with the church. He questioned things like transubstantiation. Does the bread and wine become ontologically really the body and blood of Christ, you know, rather than to have a kind of sacramental presence that's there, but I can't really explain it through human logic. He was against transubstantiation. He had problems with the luxurious lifestyles of bishops around him and so forth. Though oddly enough, he himself, his living depended upon being the priest of a place called Lutterworth in North England while he's down at Oxford. And he only saw Lutterworth late in his life, at the end of his life, when the pressure was on. And he went north to get away from Oxford and get away from church critics who were closing in on him. He also was responsible for a translation of the Bible into English. It's not the best of translations, but people picked this up. And a movement grew up around Huss called Lollardy. There are a lot of tracts that are supposedly written by Huss, but Huss actually, did I say Huss? Wycliffe, I'm sorry. Lollardy grew up around Wycliffe. The tracts alleged by Wycliffe, in fact, are written by other people, if they're in English. He only wrote Latin, except for the Bible translation. But the movement grew, and it appealed to people up and down the social ladder. And then in the early 15th century, after Wycliffe had died, he left Oxford, went back to Lutterworth, and died in 1384, had a stroke at Christmas, and that was that. The movement that grew up and continued after him is a kind of a critical movement. Against the kind of lavish lifestyle. They want a simpler Christianity, a basic Christianity, that appeal to ordinary people, the church tends to drag its feet on that. And then in the early 15th century, there was a nobleman, John Oldcastle, who led a revolt against the crown. Oldcastle happened to be a Lollard. That gives Lollardy a bad name. It becomes, let's say, not to people's advantage if you're then sort of middle of the social ladder upward to be a Lollard. And they tend to lose that segment of society, while others are forced underground because of the association of Lollardy with this uprising. It becomes illegal to have a Bible translation. No translations could be done unless they were authorized by church officials and by the crown. And between the time of 1407, when that decree was issued, and the English Reformation, when first Barnes and then Tyndale also write and Coverdale write, and we get English translations, between that time, there are exactly zero that are printed and appear in England. The Germans had a good couple of handfuls before Luther even came along. They weren't the best, but they were around and there. So people like Wycliffe are there, and he becomes kind of a reformer and is idolized by others from afar. I don't think they always quite understood what he was about, but he becomes a symbol for reform. But he doesn't get anywhere because of those various circumstances. Short on Wycliffe comes John Huss, a Bohemian reformer. John Huss wanted justification taught in a more simpler fashion. He's far more traditional Roman Catholic than Wycliffe was on almost everything except justification. And Wycliffe had rather radical ideas for reforming on almost everything except justification. When Luther came along, he looked at Huss's writings and he said Huss is right as far as justification is concerned. He said at one point, we are all Hussites. In other words, we really echo his ideas that are there. Huss was associated with the Bohemian church. Its problem was that they wanted communion in both kinds, both the cup and the host, the bread and the wine, the body and the blood. This had not been commonly done since about the 13th century. There was a church council that required people to go to confession and communion once a year. This was a way of keeping track of people and keeping them within the church and out of a heretical group that was growing at the time. In the course of talking about what communion was, that same church council declared transubstantiation a doctrine. Well, okay, fine and good. But then Christ said, take, eat, take, drink. And the Bohemians said, we should still get the cup. And the church was not very eager to give it to the lay people for a variety of reasons. The priests could still have it and could sort of commune for them. Well, the Bohemians didn't want to put up with this. And Huss, preaching his reform efforts theologically and agitating for these things, was called to Constance in 14, the Council's 14 to 18. In 1415, John Huss is burned at the stake. He had been granted safe conduct. They said, well, you've discussed your ideas here. That broke your agreement not to talk until you talk to the council. He said, I've only talked privately to people who've come. And they said, that private is still talking. He said, I haven't preached about it. Didn't matter. Private is still talking. And so Huss is put to death at Constance. The result after that was civil war for a while in Bohemia with people taking up arms in behalf of their theological position. So you've got reformers, individuals, and people like Wycliffe and Huss who are trying to make changes in the church, and yet they don't still have the same impact. And your question then is, well, why don't these things succeed? Why doesn't the conciliarism succeed, the monastic efforts, the papal reform, the mystics, the individual people like Wycliffe and Huss? And the answer is very simple, but it's probably not very satisfactory, and that's simply that conditions didn't come together the right way at the right time. You haven't got a Luther. You haven't got sort of political factors and also ecclesiastical factors in Rome in the same way as you do in Luther's day. You don't have a new wave of liberal arts learning that has cracked the universities like will happen at Wittenberg. And you haven't got other things like the printing press, for example. You know, just Luther, once the Reformation erupted, between 1517 and 1520, he wrote 30 different treatises. And we know from looking at the printer's records, because they keep track of, you know, how many copies they print, because they want to know how much money they make. And you know, it's business, they're businessmen. What is our print run? When you add up those 30 different treatises, there are 300,000 copies total. That's average of 10,000 apiece. Think how long it would take to make 10,000 copies of something by hand back in the days of Wycliffe or John Huss. So circumstances are just simply different. Luther happened to come along for the sake of the Reformation at a time when a lot of other factors fell together. And he didn't orchestrate them, but he simply got them there and they're available.
You mentioned earlier, Bob, about justification, and you've mentioned that term a number of times in the summary of sort of the things that led up to Luther's time. The Church, as I understand it, never denied justification. So what made Luther's understanding of justification different than that which was being taught, say, by the papacy or Wycliffe or some of these others?
Yes, you're quite right. Justification is a central feature of Christianity. Then we get into definition, and then begin some of the difficulties. Perhaps the best place to kind of look at it, at least leading into Luther and Reformation, is to go to universities in the 12th and in the 13th centuries. In the 12th century, there is a kind of, it's called the 12th century Renaissance. This is not the same Renaissance we think of with Michelangelo and the art in Italy and then art north of the Alps and writing and liberal arts education. This is a kind of smaller clerical revival within the Church of something very particular. And the thing they latched upon were the ideas of Aristotle. Aristotle was a disciple of Plato in classical antiquity. He was interested in the world around him, more kind of, you would say, kind of science of his day. And in order to study this, he developed an approach that used logic and syllogisms, looking at the world. It depends a lot on if, therefore. See, if this is... If this is the Lutheran Inquisitor on Lutheran Radio UK, and if Reverend John Ehlers is the host of the show, therefore, we would say the other voice, not mine, that they hear must be that of John Ehlers. See, there's logic. If nations need a capital city, and if England is a nation, then England has to have a capital city. See, now, people could say, well, political capital, that's London, but the cultural capital, that's, you know, I don't know, Petswood, something like that. And you can get into arguments over things. But basically, if, therefore, is a logic that revolves around the idea of ergo, therefore. If, therefore. And the Church first was a little bit wary of Aristotle because he's a pagan Greek. And then when university professors showed how he could be used to help organize and work through thought processes, then the Church said, fine. And not only did he become a useful tool, he became really the only way anybody could study anything in medieval curricula. Classical liberal arts said you should study grammar, and then also logic, and then rhetoric. Different ways of communicating, but logic became the only kind of communication tool that they had. So they applied this then to the Scriptures, and they said, well, look, read the texts, and what do we find out? We find out that there's a God there who gives law. He has standards. He is a righteous God who demands holiness. So if God is just and right, and if God makes no mistakes, and if God gives you, human beings, a law and says, keep this, this is my will, this is what I want you to do, therefore, there must be some way, shape, or form in which you can keep this law. Now, you may refine it and say, oh, yes, but we're sinful. Yeah, but there still must be some way in which you can do this, perhaps enabled by grace, supplemented by grace, or empowered by grace. Because if you say, oh, I can't do it by any stretch of the imagination, then you've made God a fool. See, because God wouldn't give you the law if you couldn't do it somehow. It may be very hard, but you should be able to do it. And what developed then was this idea that God will come, he will give you grace and faith, and then will infuse grace throughout life. You will use these gifts that God gives you in order to, therefore, follow after. You believe, of course, but you also do. And justification becomes a process of becoming righteous. Righteousness is understood as a kind of thing or a quantity that you must eventually attain in order to get to heaven and get eternal life. In the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas had that system, and he had the famous phrase, fides caritate formata, faith formed by love, by works of love, good works. Then a little later came a variation in medieval theology, in the medieval academic world, that said, well, what about, how does this start, however? I mean, why in the world should God give us grace and faith in the first place? And they kind of added a little part to the beginning. And they said, people are fallen. Yes, we're sinful. But there's a little spark of goodness left in everybody. And this little spark of goodness enables me to initiate, enables me to do something that is positive in response to God's law and God's demand. I may not, if God could say, all right, for right now, from where you're sitting in the chair, jump up and slap both hands on the ceiling. And I think, I can't possibly do that. But if I even sort of look at the ceiling and contemplate the possibility and wish I could, that's a positive thing. See, and then he comes and says, okay, here's grace and faith. Their famous phrase was much longer, is facientibus quod in se est Deus non denegat gratiam. To those who do the best that's in them, God will not deny them grace. See, you make the first little effort, God gives you grace and faith, and now we're off to the process, on the process once again. Again, becoming righteous through life until finally I achieve a level where I have enough righteousness accrued, enough quantity built up, so that God says, fine, here you are. The problem with that, of course, is that you always have the big question, how much is enough? Have I done the right thing for God to give me grace and faith? Well, if I think I have grace and faith, I've probably done the right thing. So I've at least gotten off the start, you know, off the mark. But now, throughout my life, have I done enough to get to the end? See, I try and try and try. How much is enough? How do I find a loving God? And that's the question that drove Luther crazy, because he grows up in this system that says, yes, there is God there, but God is viewed more as the judge on the rainbow with the fire coming out of his mouth and the sword coming in terror to judge the world. And everyone is standing there kind of feebly holding what he's acquired, what he's attained, what he's amassed in his lifetime. Is that going to work? And Luther thought, well, that's what drove him into the monastery. He's off to be a law student, and then he's heading now toward law studies. And instead, when the thunderstorm comes, he heads into the monastery because he thinks he can do more good things. That's the problem with the justification in the medieval process, in the medieval doing. There's no peace, and Luther's looking for peace. This is what eventually will bring him to Reformation. That's kind of a second part of the answer, a second part of the thought that we should probably pursue another time.
On that nice segue, Dr. Rosin, we have come to the end of our time. So we would encourage our listeners to join us next week as we carry on this conversation with Dr. Robert Rosin.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.